Welcome to Disciple Dojo. This afternoon, I had a great time chatting with my friend Kurt Jarris. Kurt runs Veracity Hill, which is an apologetics ministry. And so we just talked about all kinds of stuff related to apologetics, related to theology, related to celebrity pastors, the need for accountability in the world of apologetics. Why are some apologists jerks? We talked about Bart Ehrman. We had a good time. So I'm excited for you guys to hear this conversation. Be sure to check the video description below for links to a number of the things that we talk about in this episode. And also, before we jump in, if you haven't already, really love for you to click that subscribe button. And when you do, hit the little bell icon, enable notifications. That's how YouTube knows to let you know when Disciple Dojo is putting out more content. So when we do a live stream, that's how you'll know. When we do Bible giveaways, that's how you'll know. So we appreciate all of you who subscribe, supported this ministry. You are in a very tangible way responsible for the continued growth of this channel. So thank you so much. All right, let's talk to Dr. Kurt Jarris about apologetics. So we are here with Dr. Kurt Jarris. I made sure to say that right. A lot of people probably pronounce. How do people usually say it? What do you usually hear?
You know, I get Jarros quite a bit. I live in a town that's 50% Hispanic, so it's very common for Jarros.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Jarris is the way it's pronounced. So nicely done. Thank you.
I'm sure if you go into European settings, they might pronounce it Jarros or something like that.
So my wife and I, my wife did a Facebook Marketplace deal for a piece of furniture years ago. And we met someone from Slovakia. I'm Czech. Uh-huh. You know, if you know your European history, Czechoslovakia.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman recognized my last name and she said, "Oh, do you say Jarros?" And that was the first time I had heard an Eastern European pronunciation of my last name.
Yeah. And you're like, "No, I've Americanized it. It's Jarris."
Yeah, yeah. Generations. I'm like, you know, let's see, off the top of my head, fourth or fifth gen at this point. So,
well, it's good to know for pronouncing somebody's names right. It's tricky because I read a lot and I read a lot of scholars and authors who have names that I have no idea how to pronounce. And so frequently in study Bible reviews or whatever, when I quote someone, I'm just like, I'm going to butcher this name, but I've never heard it. At SBL, it's fun because you get to meet people and then you can hear, "Oh, that's how you say your name." So yep. Very helpful. Well,
but if anybody forgets, just Dr. J is short and sweet, nice and easy. I did a dissertation years of my life researching only just to make it more easy for people.
Yes. That's why, that's one of the reasons you should do a PhD is just to make your name easier to pronounce. That's what I hear. What was your, you did your PhD. What was your PhD in? What was your dissertation? What's your focus? What is your doctorate?
Yeah. So I hold the degree from the University of Aberdeen. Mm-hmm. And my doctoral research was studying the so-called semi-Pelagians and their view of original sin in particular. You know, with doctoral research, you've got to go super narrow.
Yeah.
And so some people have studied, I call them the Gallic monks, since they weren't semi-Pelagian. So the Gallic monks, but nobody had really studied their view of original sin and, you know, presented sort of a synthesis of their views.
Mm-hmm.
And there was only one journal, academic journal article that was like, 4 pages long on John Cassian's view of original sin. So it's just like not even tip of the iceberg in terms of looking at his corpus and being able to, you know, formulate a proper formal doctrine of original sin.
Right.
So yeah, my academic book, it's like 330 pages. I don't have it published yet, but it's out there on the interwebs for people who want to try and find it.
We'll put a link to it in the show notes because we have people, we have all levels of theology nerds that watch Disciple Dojo.
Sure.
So there are going to be some viewers who are like, "I want to see what this guy's written," and they'll track it down.
It's some heavy stuff, just going in deep. It's not an easy read. But, you know, it was enjoyable for me and for the nerds that like doing this sort of research. Yes, I'd be more than happy to share the link.
Yeah. Now, what drew you to that in particular? Because it's this confluence of church history and theology. There's, yes, I'm sure, some apologetic value in it. So, yep, kind of, you know, what was the draw? What was the driving motivator to make you want to spend years of your life digging into this one specific area?
Yeah. So, you know, it really got started by thinking about soteriology, or, you know, the study of salvation. I first learned about Calvinism when I was in high school. I didn't identify as a Calvinist, far from it. And so there was sort of Arminianism as this alternative.
Right.
When I was in college, my professors at Biola, my Bible professors, frequently told me, well, you're either a Calvinist or you are an Arminian. There's really no other other options. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we call a false dichotomy. Mm-hmm. In fact, there are other options that are logical possibilities. And so I began to study theology more and came across this concept of semi-Pelagians, semi-Pelagianism. And it was the idea that man could take the first step towards salvation devoid of grace. Right. Well, I sort of like that idea of taking a first step, that there is this synergistic view of salvation, but that whole devoid of grace is a little, not sure about that. So I began to read the primary sources. So it was commonly attributed that John Cassian and some others in modern day Southern France, back then it was Roman Gaul, back in the 5th century, so 400s, they advocated for this view of semi-Pelagianism. Well, you go back and read the primary sources, and they do not hold to what it's called semi-Pelagianism. And so I got interested to study them more. And really, one of the motivating factors was that these Christian monks were being treated, still to this day, are treated and attacked as holding to a straw man. So one of my interests was in just salvaging their reputation, whether you agreed with their views or not, right? So a lot of my, some of my debates, a lot of my videos that talk about the Gallic monks is really more of a historical approach. But as you observed, it's sort of the synthesis between history and systematic theology. So in those types of videos about the Gallic monks, I'm not telling a Calvinist to not be a Calvinist. I'm just asking them to do good history,
right,
and to be a fair critic of the Gallic monks.
Yeah.
So we want to steel man our opponents. So let's fairly, you know, we want to have fair dialogue. We want to discover truth. And, you know, so through basically uncovering this complex issue and clarifying the issues, that's what got me interested in studying the Gallic monks. Yeah. So, and then it's related to apologetics, because what do we think of the nature of humans? What did Adam pass on to his posterity, right? This is classic doctrine of original sin. And do humans retain the ability to make free choices without super added grace, or that is grace that's given to the grace that's already been given?
Yeah.
So one of the monks, Faustus of Rees, he calls this the prima gratia, the first grace. So there is this sense of what we might call natural free will, but God's grace is there. And so it's not an either or between grace and free will. It's a both and.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot. There's a lot more questions that I would love to ask about that. And maybe I want to bring you back sometime and we can do a deeper dive on soteriology. Because people have so many questions about this. And like you said, people throw around concepts like Pelagian, semi-Pelagian. Most people, especially like the cage stage Calvinist, you know, you first become a Calvinist and everything is like, this is the true gospel. Why is nobody teaching this? All of these heretic churches, I must defend the truth. And they just, and even other Calvinists are like, dude, just chill for a minute and sit with this for a while. Yeah. They'll just start throwing out these charges. Like, you know, it's a man-centered soteriology and it's, you're doing all the works and you're earning salvation and this and that. And it's annoying because you're being told what you believe and you don't believe that. But I've also found, to be honest, non-Calvinists do the same thing to Calvinists a lot by saying, oh, you just believe in determinism. You just believe we're robots. You just believe, like, both sides really do straw man each other rather than steel man. And I've noticed in your work that you make a concerted effort to not do that. And that's one of the things that I have always appreciated about, I mean, this is the first time we've like talked in real time, but
Even though we've engaged on Facebook for years and I feel like I know you. Yeah, it's true. Yeah. This is the first time we're talking.
we've exchanged messages and comments back and forth and we've sort of, I guess, followed each other's social media footprint. But I have noticed that you're, even when you are dipping your toe into polemics, you always do it in a way that is, I think, inviting rather than alienating. And I appreciate that. And so I wanted to have you on and to point viewers to your ministry, what you're doing, give them a little bit of your background, who you are, and to talk about just the whole concept of apologetics, because you have founded and are the head of an apologetics ministry. Am I right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell the viewers about it. What do you do? I mean, after you got this dissertation on a bunch of French monks, then you went and you found an apologetics ministry. So what's going on there?
Sure. Yeah. So Veracity Hill is a speaking teaching ministry. And essentially this is where I, you know, develop content, create videos. And for some years I had done a podcast and that went on what I called an indefinite hiatus, but we're working on bringing that back.
Okay.
And relaunching. So I'm looking forward to that. Certain types of content, better planning on my part as well than the previous version. I've got some blog posts at my website, veracityhill.com. I actually have a few blog posts in basically waiting to go up, some drafts of some material. And it's on some biblical studies too.
Nice.
I've had someone sending me stuff on giants, archaeological giants discovered. It's kind of like, I've just got it. Get a blog article up because I can refer people when they say, hey, did you see this? Right? People think it's like the Nephilim.
No.
Go to the primary source. There's a 6-foot skeleton buried next to some shorter people, and now they're saying it's a giant. You're just like,
those pesky primary sources. Why do you want to bother with those? This is the internet age.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
So Veracity Hill, is it a one-man operation? Do you have a team? Do you have a board? How are you set up?
Yeah, so Veracity Hill is, I said it's a speaking teaching ministry because it falls under my umbrella organization, Defenders Media, 501c3. And Defenders Media, you know, we create thought-provoking theological media. We've got clients. We work with Mike Lacona and Craig Keener. Mm-hmm. So we produce their podcasts. I'm kind of their Robin to their Batman, if you will, on the podcasts.
Right.
So they're the brainiacs there. And we've got other clients as well. Some of them are even silent partners. We just kind of, we're in the background helping folks, not as public. So that's sort of Defenders. So we've got our clients and our own ministries, and Veracity Hill is the speaking teaching ministry there. So I do have, you know, a small team at Defenders that helps me produce the material, the content, video editing, graphics, other things, help me put on events locally. Yeah. I'm in the western suburbs of Chicago, so we've put on events throughout the years. So that's basically it. But, you know, I think what makes my ministry a little different than from other apologetics ministries is I'm not tribalistic. Mm-hmm. So I'm not interested in defending my side just because it's my side.
Right.
So I'm what's called an equal opportunity offender. I'm happy to kind of, you know, call the shots as I see them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I a few years ago now, 2 or 3 years ago, I did this video series defending, of all people, Bart Ehrman, right? Mm-hmm. Bart Ehrman is kind of like the Darth Vader to evangelical Christians, right? He's the big baddie. And, you know, I hadn't read his most popular book, Misquoting Jesus.
Mm.
And I thought, hey, I'll give it a read, see what I think, and, you know, make some content from it. Well, as I was reading it, I came away thinking, gosh, this is a lot different than what I was told about the book and what other Christian apologists themselves have taught about the book.
Mm.
And if it's okay with you, I've got just a quick example of this.
Yeah. Let's share it with you. And for the viewers who aren't as Bible nerdy in the know of who Bart Ehrman is, he's a professor of religion at UNC Chapel Hill, I believe. He studied under Bruce Metzger, one of the most influential textual critics of the New Testament ever. And he, at some point in his academic studies. He came from an evangelical, more conservative background, veered into agnosticism, maybe atheism, skepticism, to the point where in misquoting Jesus, he had a famous line, and we quoted in Bible for the Rest of Us that we don't have the copies. We don't have the copies
Yeah, I'm going to give that example right here. Yeah.
So for those who don't know Bart Ehrman, that's kind of who he is. And I saw Kurt's series that he did, and it impressed me because the exact same thing that you mentioned. I read Misquoting Jesus back when it came out, and I read it and was like, this is actually a pretty good explanation of how text criticism work. It's his conclusions that I think are mostly wrong.
Sure. It's some of those later chapters.
Yeah.
It's some of those later chapters where he kind of gives his own take that one might object to, but a lot of it is introductory material and the history of textual criticism. Yeah. I mean, if I were a professor teaching freshmen, sophomores about textual criticism, I would actually have no issue using Misquoting Jesus as a textbook in the class. That's how much I would consider, because, you know, I don't have to find someone that I agree with on everything in order to consider using as an academic resource.
Right.
Exactly. When you're teaching through a book, you can raise questions and, you know.
Yeah.
So I'd have no
problem. So what's the example? So tell the viewers an example of how you differ from a lot of apologists on Ehrman.
Yeah. So let me, you sort of said that opening line, we don't have the copies of the copies.
Right.
What we have are copies much later. In most instances, they are copies made from many centuries later, and all these copies differ from one another in many thousands of places, yada, 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 right? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, so here's a Christian apologist, Timothy Paul Jones, and he recently put out a Christianity Today article on the importance of apologetics, so it's called Misquoting Truth, and here's a line from this book, okay? In the first place, misquoting Jesus grossly overestimates the significance of the differences between the manuscripts. Ehrman's estimate of 400,000 variants among the New Testament manuscripts may be numerically correct, but what Ehrman doesn't clearly communicate to his readers is the insignificance of the vast majority of these variants.
All right. So now let's hear from Ehrman in the book.
So I just read for you that paragraph about the copies of the copies, yada, yada. The very first line of the next paragraph, you can see I've got it highlighted.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these differences are completely immaterial and insignificant. A good portion of them simply show us that scribes in antiquity could spell no better than most people can today, and they didn't even have dictionaries, let alone spell check. He continues on. He is explicit that the vast majority, most of these differences are completely immaterial and it's insignificant.
Yep.
Right there, it's an explicit nuance contra to the numerical value.
Mm-hmm.
So what TPJ says as a Christian apologist is just false. Mm-hmm. And I go so far as to say, I mean, it's bearing false witness, right? It is a straw man. We need to steel man the arguments that we see where we disagree with Ehrman. But that, I mean, and he's not the only one. I mean, Greg Kokel's done it. Even Peter Williams, the Cambridge scholar, also straw mans. Mm. Now, I give these other names because I give the examples and I use them. I think I found audio files or videos that I had put into this 6-part series where I go through this.
Mm.
So as Christian apologists, you know, we have to defend the truth, right? So if we're going to be defending a position that's not true, that tarnishes the reputation, not just of that person, but of all of us Christians collectively,
yeah.
Right? Because it gives a bad name to Christian apologetics. Oh, you're one of those people. I mean, apologetics already has a bad name in the sense that people think it's quarrelsome and argumentative. Instead, we want to try to change that public perception as winsome persuasion.
Yeah.
Right. We want to be winsome and persuasive to people. We want to be salt, the right. Salt of the earth. Don't want to be tribalistic and combative.
Yeah, exactly. Polemic for polemic's sake.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Because I read Misquoting Jesus when it came, or not long after it came out, and I read Misquoting Truth, and this was all around Da Vinci Code time. I mean, this was sort of in that era. So there was a lot of this I feel like people were sort of leaning on Ehrman, saying, this is what Ehrman says, so you can't trust any, like taking that and going maybe further than he did. But also later in the book, Ehrman does put a lot of weight on some of these variants in New Testament manuscripts.
Yeah.
And so while he, so I'm going to devil's advocate with you to try to see maybe what the apologist might've been thinking is, while he may admit in the beginning that these are trivial, most of them are just spelling errors, the later parts of the book, he puts a lot of emphasis on the fact that we can't really know any, really what the text is. Textual suspicion, you know, we can't, yeah. We just can't know. And he does, at least from what I remember, he does seem to, that's where Ehrman ends up landing, even if he doesn't construct his argument that way. Do you think that's a fair summary, or is this me misreading Ehrman as well? And if so, I'm happy to be corrected, because this was like 15 years ago when I read his book.
Yeah. So in the video series, you know, I pull from his textbook on New Testament introduction.
Yeah.
And it's behind me on my shelf there. And I could pull the passage for you where he basically says that, you know, with 99% reliability, we can reconstruct what the original said.
Mm.
So now to after, your point,
was that after or before misquoting Jesus?
I think it was before. Now he's okay. There are revisions, you know, editions, newer editions where he says the same thing.
Okay.
Because Ehrman's a textual critic. I mean, it's, you know,
yeah.
It's there. The words are there. So we can reliably reconstruct the New Testament, plain and simple. And Ehrman, that's a paraphrase, but that's a faithful paraphrase of Ehrman's position. Now, I want to say two things. One, you said some people will take what Ehrman said about the copies of the copies and say, well, we can't really know what was there.
Right.
Well, they will interpret Ehrman that way, and they won't continue reading to the very next line, you know, and they won't keep reading Ehrman. So they will sort of take that. And the question then is, you know, where is the responsibility? Yeah. I mean, as I said, Ehrman does provide these nuances and distinctions. And it's the people who maybe did not want to seek out the truth further. They wanted to hear that first part and then they're comfortable leaving and, right. you know, just reciting that. That is a problem. Mm. So, but I'm not persuaded that that burdens on Ehrman. It's on the reader.
Right.
Now, the second thing you said was about, you know, some of his other conclusions. Yes, there are some passages where it seems that Ehrman's philosophical assumptions about, say, the political debates that occurred, both in the theological discussions and in the transmission process, you know, there is that bias there. And he does put an overemphasis on these variants, but it's a handful of examples,
right.
and these are the sort of the best that there are. It's not like he's just pulling a few select ones.
Right.
These handful, I mean, that's it. And again, if you consider Ehrman's views on these, on the conclusions of what the text should have said, that still implies that Ehrman thinks he knows what the original said. He just thinks that a later change, which was a theologically motivated change from, say, a proto-Orthodox view, you know, infiltrated the process. Okay, but again, let's say you agree with Ehrman. You still, if you agree with him, you can still get to the original.
Mm.
So there's not really this warrant for a deep skepticism
right.
that we can't know what the original said.
Yeah.
We can. Now, I say all this because I guess several years ago now, Ehrman did a debate against Dan Wallace, where he seems to change his view, where he says, well, we can't really know what the original said. And he gives some examples. I use this video in my 6-part series. I think Bart simply took the position for kind of a marketing ploy. Yeah. I mean, his arguments aren't the strongest. And again, it's a shift of his position. Right. And it's not in the literature. It's just for a debate. So I wonder if he kind of just did it for marketing. I'd be interested to talk to him about it sometime. But, you know,
that brings up something to think about, which is a lot of times we approach something, if it's been put in writing, as this is what so-and-so believes, full stop. And there have been numerous times, it happens in biblical studies, it happens in discourse, I mean, it just happened I was on social media, at least. I haven't seen it firsthand, but Richard Hayes apparently has changed his views on the Bible's sexual ethics.
Yes, and
has
I saw that. Yeah.
The idea that you can never, that you never change your mind is something that I think we inherently just assume when we read something like this is permanent, yep. But people change their mind a lot. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, I think that's the mark of a good thinker, that, depending on the issue and how you change your mind, but being yes. willing to change your position based on being convinced by something. Yeah. I don't think that's anything. I think that's something that we should regularly keep in mind. Like people can do that and you're free to do that. And it should push you to what are the arguments that they're giving for why they did it.
Yep.
Which makes a big difference. And I appreciated that about your series on Bart Ehrman, because Bart Ehrman, I mean, he cultivated a brand. He cultivated a brand of, you know, former evangelical or former fundamentalist or whatever he would label yep. it, now agnostic, Jesus wasn't divine, you know, just this kind of stuff. But a lot of times people take him and run with it. And he's had to correct people and say, no, this whole Jesus is a myth thing, like that's ridiculous. He existed. And it's anybody who knows anything about history knows that Jesus existed. So he is a figure that he's a very interesting figure. And it's neat yeah. to see somebody doing a series, an evangelical apologist actually saying, I'm not going to just attack him. I'm going to interact with him in a productive yep. way.
I think Bart has done a good job at critiquing fundamentalist views of the scripture. Mm-hmm. We could even say ignorant views of the scripture. Mm-hmm. The way that 20th century evangelicals and now 21st century evangelicals, although evangelicalism is evolving itself, the way that they have interpreted the text in a very wooden way without some of the basic hermeneutical principles, mm-hmm. you know, like what is the genre of this text? That's pretty important. Right, they just right. kind of, well, the text says what it says. Well, no, you're implying a genre or a standard upon the text
yeah.
that the author may not have intended, you know, to convey.
Yeah.
So Bart's been good for that, for mm-hmm. attacking the fundamentalist views. Mm-hmm. Although I'm not persuaded that, you know, his arguments do the sort of work that he wants it to accomplish.
Right.
You know, I just read Lost Christianities. And I'm stronger than in my faith than ever before. You know, I wasn't persuaded by his arguments. I learned some new stuff, which was neat. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just don't think the arguments did the sort of work he was looking for.
That's how I felt after reading Misquoting Jesus. Reading that and having been through seminary and done textual criticism, and that's why we use that book as an example in Bible for the Rest of Us. And then we walk people through an exercise, a very, very oversimplified exercise yeah. of how to do text criticism. But the whole point is I'm more convinced after reading it that we can not only reconstruct the text to an astounding degree of certainty, not perfect certainty, but that also the text is trustworthy and reliable. But that's a different, I mean, that's, you're moving from text criticism into philosophy and into assumptions, which, you know, those are two different areas, and sometimes people aren't quick to delineate which area they're dealing with. Did you ever read, it's behind me on the shelf, I'm trying to find the name, Myths and Misunderstandings of New Testament Text Criticism, Elijah Hickson, and who was the other author?
Oh, Myths and Mistakes.
Myths and Mistakes. Sorry. Yeah. It was covered up by Batman here behind me. Yes. Myths and Mistakes. Did you ever read that work?
I haven't read it, no, but I did. I have interviewed Peter. He's been on my Brad City Hill program.
Yeah,
when it came out. Yeah,
yeah. I picked it up a couple of years ago, and it was again. It was similar to, very similar to what you're doing. Your approach is these are guys that are like, hey, we are text critics. We are the ones that do this stuff with the magnifying glasses and the, you know, X-ray scanner of the manuscripts. And is this a fleck of ink or is this a piece of parchment or, you know, like,
yep,
we're doing this stuff. And apologists and theologians and even some biblical scholars are overstating the evidence. And that yep. it's a whole book of scholars. And I don't know if they would all be self-described evangelicals. The idea I got was that they would be, but taking to task fellow evangelicals saying, guys, stop making bad arguments. This is, you're saying more than is true. Mm. And I was like, that is so refreshing and so needed, because it's when you hear something that's good, you want to believe it, and then you want to tell other people about it. And without the fact checking, man, that just becomes, I mean, we live in the era of that with social media and forwarding and fake news. And it's nice seeing that. It's nice seeing what you're doing with Veracity Hill. So viewers, that's why, one of the reasons that I wanted Kurt to come on and talk is because we want to encourage that, you know, like that, that's a good thing. Why is it, let me ask you about apologetics. Why does apologetics have a dubious reputation in some quarters? And that's a very broad question, so you can take it in whatever direction you want.
Yeah, but no, it's a great question, because the reality is that it does. And for so many reasons, yes, broad question. So one of the reasons why, among many, is that it's very tribalistic. It's more tribalistic than you realize, because so commonly apologists as well will give their answer. So without surveying the field of other plausible answers. So let me give a hypothetical example.
Yeah.
Suppose there's a young man, he's raised in a Christian home, and he was taught young earth creationism. He goes to school, off to college, say, even, and discovers holy buckets. The science says old earth, evolutionary theory, therefore the Bible's false. He goes to his parents and says, hey, here's what I'm learning in science class. I'm learning that the age of the earth is so many millions of years old. The universe is billions of years old. And that, you know, basically humans are here because we've evolved through small changes over a long period of time. Mm. What do the parents say? Well, the Bible says God created the earth in 6 days and rested on the seventh. So you can sort of see what I'm getting at here, that apologetics for this person is sort of this tribalism. Well, you know, that's not what we believe. We believe this. And it's usually this narrow take. It's a one particular perspective and interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2.
Right.
And so that person then very well may leave the faith because they think the truth says one thing and their parents believe something different. Well, so what I've been doing with Veracity Hill, I mentioned that we put on events here in Chicagoland, and I've presented multi-views. So all the way back, let's see, 2018, we did the alleged genocide commands in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. We invited Paul Copan, Clay Jones, John Walton, and Kenton Sparks. All these guys are published academics on the subject. In 2019, we did Gospel Differences. Mike Lycona, Bart Ehrman, Rob Bowman, and Craig Keener. We invited Bart Ehrman to this event. So, and he blogged about it. He had a good time.
Yeah.
He was very well received. And then just last year, we put on what I called a hell of a conference. It was on four different views of hell. And so we brought in, again, published representatives on that. And so why do we have these different views? Well, because I don't want one particular view to be an obstacle for people to have faith in Jesus Christ.
Exactly.
So there are these plausible views, and it's so commonly the case that young Christians are unaware of the different plausible options available to them to say, hey, that view that my parents hold, that's maybe not what I think. But you know what? I think I could chew and swallow that one. That one seems defensible.
Right.
Or that one's compatible with my view of, say, divine justice. So, yeah, I just want to make the options available for people. And again, this I'd like to think this gives a better flavor of apologetics, because it's not so pointed. It's not confrontational. It's not so narrow-minded as well.
Yeah.
Because while I have my own positions, I understand that there are plausible, even defensible, rational positions elsewhere within any particular issue.
Yeah. Yeah. It's ecumenical too. You're not immediately, like, if you give, and this is what just annoys me to no end. Whether it's Genesis days or eschatology, people think that they have to die on a hill of a particular reading of a text. And as a Bible teacher, it it frustrates me so much because I'm like, that's not the only way that Christians have ever read this text. There's hundreds, yep, even sometimes thousands of years of different approaches to it. So not giving people the options, to me, whether it's a Bible teacher doing it, whether it's an apologist doing it, whether it's a pastor doing it, whether it's a parent doing it, not giving them the options is theological malpractice. You are crippling someone's ability to have a relationship with God because you're chaining it to a particular tradition. And that doesn't mean that you don't have your views. That doesn't, you know, I tell people all the time, I have my own views when it comes to eschatology, when it comes to creation, when it comes to the Canaanite genocide passages. I have my own views and I'm happy to present those and defend them if I'm asked to, but I'm not going to say this is persuasive to me, therefore you have to believe it or you don't take scripture seriously. And that's what just drives me nuts about, like, the Ken Hams or the Jack Van Impe's, Tim LaHaye's, the just all of the people out there that build whole ministries around teaching a particular idiosyncratic interpretation of scripture as if it is the only one. And I rarely name names, but those are just some that throw out because they do it so much that it just drives me crazy. And I want to just steer people away and say there's better stuff. Go look at Veracity Hill stuff. Go read some of these other scholars. Grab the Zondervan Counterpoint series. I mean, I've got a number of the volumes right beside me where they let good, top-notch scholars interact with each other and critique each other and then respond to those critiques. To me, that's the best way there is to learn theology.
Let me give us a second reason why apologetics sort of has this bad taste in people's mouths. Because apologists can be hypocrites.
Mm.
So they will object to cancel culture, but they will attack the He Gets Us ads because they're not good enough and because it's not allegedly a proclamation of the gospel.
Man.
So I put out this short video basically saying, you know, this is targeted to a certain people group of people who are Bible illiterate or even Christian illiterate in the sense that at this juncture in America, there are people who are unchurched.
Mm-hmm.
And so Christians have a bad reputation, generally speaking.
Yep.
Especially amongst, say, secular groups.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we reach them? Well, we need to first change the perception that these people have about Jesus or Christians. So they create this ad about Christians washing the feet of people that are maybe considered social outcasts, right? Well, what do the conservatives say? The conservatives say, oh, it's not good enough. It's not good enough ad. There's no mention of sin or a savior or this and that.
Yeah.
And I said, look, yeah, you could do an ad like that, but it's going to reach a certain type of person. They're trying to reach even people further away.
Yep.
But so here it is, sort of this bickering and complaining. And again, it's just it's hypocritical regarding the cancel culture because the He Gets Us isn't good enough. Meanwhile, they'll probably go and embrace like Kirk Cameron's sort of, you know, movies. And I'm just like, this is, you know,
I remember
quality content.
Your video, when it came out, I shared it because I was like, this is exactly how I felt. And Disciple Dojo, I did a short, not very long one, but a response because somebody asked me about it as well. And we were on the same page on that one. I thought, you will never please people who are determined to see a conspiracy behind every bush.
Yep.
What was fascinating to me about He Gets Us was my super left-wing progressive Christian friends attacked it just as much, but not because Jesus was washing the feet of somebody in an abortion clinic or LGBT. No, because it was funded by the Hobby Lobby people. And so they saw it as a right-wing attempt to, and somebody was like, this is so judgmental. Look at all how they portrayed, you know, people, gay people. It's anti-gay. It's anti-choice. It's this and that. And I was like, you sound exactly like my fundamentalist friends who think it's a social justice, CRT, Trojan horse. And I was like, you guys are both nuts. Both of you on both sides, go sit down, let the grownups talk. Like, this is a good ad for what it is, which is a taste, a come and see invitation to get people to read the Bible and learn about Jesus.
Yeah.
And I was like, you're expecting it to be an entire systematic theology, you're crazy. It's a,
yeah, a 30-second ad. Terrible
criticism.
Right. Yep. You know, it's common. What happens when people leave the faith, you know, former Christians, they stay fundamentalists.
Yes.
They just change the jersey that they're wearing.
Oh my gosh. That deserves to be highlighted. That is so true. There are few people more fundamentalist in their behavior than former evangelicals.
Yep.
You know, like,
and they interpret the Bible the same exact way. They just reject that it's true.
Exactly. You know? It's and mirror images. And boy, do they not like it when you say that, or yep. when you point yep. that out. I get a lot of hate on social media when I point out how much alike people on both extremes are, theologically and politically. That yep. people just tribalism is one of the most defining marks of our current society, I think.
Yep.
If you're not this, you're this. Oh, you support this? Well, you must support this. And then they'll start arguing against all those things rather than the thing you're actually arguing.
Yeah, they'll want to label people. So I did a debate in 2020 with none other than Douglas Wilson mm-hmm. over the horrible decree, which is basically, you know, has God decreed even evil and suffering to occur?
Mm-hmm.
And so Wilson took the affirmative. But in the introductions to the debate, the moderator had labeled me an Arminian, and I wanted to clarify that I don't identify as an Arminian, mm-hmm. Even though that's kind of how it was marketed.
Yeah.
And so you could see people in the comments, because the moderator's got a largely reformed audience.
Sure.
They were trying to figure out, well, if he's not an Arminian, well, what is he? I mean, is he open theist? Is he this and that? I'm just like, you know, they were trying to come up with a label.
Yeah.
To pin me down. Because they had trouble boxing me in, like it's almost as if they didn't even want to entertain my arguments that I'd be presenting. They just wanted to know what I would label myself as so that they could reject me as the other, you know?
Yeah.
It really is fascinating how people like those labels. And again, it's this tribalism that we see. We see it in apologetics, in theology, of course, and in apologetics. Right now, one of the hot subjects that I see is on progressive Christians, right? So we've got sort of this idea that progressive Christians aren't really Christians, or it's another gospel, or so that's an interesting subject to think about. And you've got people on both sides of the debate, and one side is saying, no, they're not Christians. The other side is saying, well, of course we're Christians, even if we hold to, you know, X, Y, and Z doctrines.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, again, you just see this tribalism, sometimes quarreling, instead of sort of a bridge building approach, which I try to take. Although that said, I mean, there are times when even bridge builders should basically say, no, that's not right. That's inappropriate, you know?
Yeah.
And it doesn't belong. So there should be, even bridge builders should be willing to kind of rebuke when the evidence calls for it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So there's two approaches. If you're trying to have unity, like spiritual unity with somebody, that's one goal. If you're trying to work with someone to accomplish something, that's a different goal. So I can't have spiritual unity with, like I was up until last year, lifelong United Methodist, Methodist Church, you know, it's God bless it. It's doing what it's going to do, but I'm out. And I can't have spiritual unity with some of my, not everybody, but the main ringleaders of Methodism and taking it the direction that it's going. I can't have spiritual unity with them because we fundamentally disagree on who God is, who Jesus is, what sin is, what the Bible is. So there's no spiritual unity, but we can and should work together on things that are common goals that are biblical justice, like advocating for refugees. I mean, my refugee jiu-jitsu program, like we meet at a church here in Charlotte, who the pastor, who's a friend of mine, is as far left as you can be. But yet where our interests come together is we both deeply, deeply care about refugee and immigrant families in our city and wanting to model the love of Jesus to them. Now, we may have very different ideas on what Jesus we're modeling, but we agree on this goal. So it's the same with, I look at groups like Secular Pro-Life, you know, and I feel really bad for them because they are constantly having to work with people who hate them because they're atheists. But yet they're like, we're going to still work with you because we fundamentally agree that it's wrong to kill small human beings for elective reasons. So that's the goal. Let's coalition and work together. So I think that if we can pull those two things apart and say, I don't have to be spiritually unified with you to work together with you. I can lock arms with my Muslim neighbors and we can advocate for things that are common interests to us. But in our society, that's a lost art. And some people in the church are like, oh no, what fellowship does light have with darkness? Why would you yoke yourself with an unbeliever? It's like, they're two different things that we're talking about. Spiritual unity is not common purpose. But it doesn't, it doesn't come out all the time.
One of the recent videos, a series of videos, clips we've been pulling from some conversations that I've held with Paulo Gia. And, you know, he, for those who are on YouTube, he's sort of a big critic of Christian apologetics and, you know, former Christian. But, while there's no spiritual unity, he's not even a Christian. We sort of agreed to hold these convos because, well, for starters, I wanted to learn more about him. Mm-hmm. But my purposes were to show that, hey, Christians can talk to atheists and to do so in a constructive, civil, cordial way, you know, and it was a blast. I want to keep doing it because I'm learning more about him, his views, and it's non-combative. Yeah. So it's like you said, it's a lost art, being able to show society, the world, that atheists and Christians can sit down together and to chat with each other. I mean, and I know with Paul, it's sort of virtual, but I would do the same thing if it were in person. Mm-hmm. And maybe he and I will get that chance.
Yeah.
So we need to be able to learn that we might have different purposes and we don't need to have the purest of standards. You can only work with these people and not those people. It's like, well, why should we think that?
Yeah.
We can build coalitions and again, towards the common goals that we do want to, you know, achieve.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's some discernment. Like I would have to seriously consider if I could share if I was invited to speak at a conference and somebody who I think is spiritually dangerous, like wolf in sheep's clothing dangerous, was invited to speak too. That would take some soul searching. And I have to be like, okay, if I were to do this, how can I make sure that my presence is not being seen as validating this person? But at the same time, it might be different for different people. It might be, there's so many other factors.
If I got a speaking invite to speak at a conference that Mark Driscoll was also at, I would use my time, at least a portion of it, to call out Mark Driscoll for his cowardice, for not being accountable to the elders at Mars Hill.
Yeah.
He is a coward, and yet he puts on this big boy masculine personality.
Yeah.
This guy, I swear, has more psychological insecurity issues than any pastor that I see out there because he just kind of projects and tries to put on this persona.
Yeah.
But I say all that because—
Have you had any interactions with him ever?
No, I've tweeted to him and he's blocked me, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, even though it was constructive, you know, it was like blocked.
Yeah.
Again, he's got these insecurities, surely.
For but viewers, again, let me just clarify for viewers, because again, we have viewers all over the world sometimes. Mark Driscoll was a very popular megachurch pastor. His church basically crumbled. Christianity Today has done a podcast series called The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. I strongly recommend listening to that podcast series, not just because of it shows you what kind of leadership that church was under, but because of the lessons that it has to teach anyone seeking to be in pastoral ministry. It is a case study on what not to do. In seminary, we would do case studies on like churches that, you know, or pastors that suffered downfalls and all this. This is a case study that every Christian should learn from.
So Driscoll refused to go under the punishment of the elders for his behavior. Mm. So he resigned. And within like 2 weeks, 7 of the 9 satellite churches dissolved within 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Now, if you're thinking about healthy church life, you would think that these congregations, even the satellite campuses, would continue meeting because it's not about the pastor. But look, what basically it's a lesson that this guy became a celebrity.
Yeah.
And people worshiped him. He became an idol for people. He's not there, we're out, right? Yeah. So that is not healthy at all. And yet here he is again. Now he's in Arizona being a pastor of a church.
Yeah. And people still, I see people post memes or quotes of his on Instagram. I'm like, yep. And they don't, to their credit, most of the time, the ones who are sharing it have no idea who he is. And they're just like, oh, I like that phrase. I'm like, well, that's a good
phrase. I like Pastor Mark. I'm just like,
look into who's saying it before sharing. Do you think, so that's an example of something that I think is a very toxic thing, which is the celebrity pastor. Pastors who have entourages, pastors who have bodyguards, pastors who are unapproachable, pastors who don't know the people in their congregation. Like all of these things I think are oxymoronic. But do you see it in apologetics? Do you see the danger of celebrity apologists?
Oh, sure. You do see it at the apologetics events. I mean, which I enjoy going to and, you know, have put on and, you know, you bring in a big name, it helps sell more tickets.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Which helps you meet your event costs. But you do see it. You know, there are pros and cons to the celebrity idea. Let's give a very popular one. Ravi Zacharias.
I was just going to say.
Right. So hugely popular apologist and an evangelist. Right. He had this way of bringing in English literature and poetry and hymns to communicate theological beliefs and apologetic issues without getting into the formal arguments like other apologists do. They get into the weeds, but you're not going to reach as big of audience if you get into the weeds. So Ravi was great at that. Well, what happened? He became such a celebrity, so much money, so much power that, hey, he's going to be an investor in a massage parlor. Where's my red flag? Like, why would the board of directors ever allow him? Why does he need the money? Why does he need a side hustle and a massage parlor of all things? You're just like, what is going on? Why is he going to, you know, Thailand for a month at a time and not communicating with his staff at all? What is this? Like, that's just bonkers. And so, you know, the investigation uncovered, you know, basically sexual affairs, abuse, you know, not to mention sort of spiritual abuse, you know, psychological abuse, which, you know, just shouldn't be had in a Christian ministry.
And I remember that one hit me. How did that affect you? Because that one hit me hard. After college, there was a summer where I strongly considered interning at RZIM when I was thinking either my path was, because I was open air apologetics all through college. I would do street preaching on campus, you know, the Cliff Connectly, like just get out there and start talking and interact with students. And that was like my thing. I did it at Harvard Square. I did it over in Cambridge, just talking to crowds, doing open air apologetics. So when I was done with my internship at the Wesley Foundation at University of Georgia, I had to decide, okay, now what I'm going to do. And it was move to Atlanta, work at RZIM, you know, get into this apologetics, or go to Gordon-Conwell, learn the languages, you know, get into, and I ended up going to that path. But so when all of this stuff with Ravi came out, I was just like, man, not only is it a bummer on just a normal level, like when any Christian leader falls, like it's a gross thing and it makes you feel bad. But I was like, this guy genuinely had, like you said, an ability. He was a brilliant communicator, orator, great on his feet, interacting with people in live Q&A settings, which is very hard to do. And it just, I was like, man, of all the things, it was a gut punch. It really was. How was it in the apologetics? Because by that time I was not in the apologetics community very actively. I don't go to conferences, don't really follow a lot of the stuff. How was it when that happened for other? But did anybody else come out and were like, "Hey guys, this needs to give us pause, and we need to reassess our board, our accountability structures," or was it just kind of like people just dropped him like a hot potato and like,
So here's another thing to think about for apologetics ministry. When you ask, what did people do? a lot of apologists don't have boards. A lot of folks are just kind of these solo ministry workers, mm. and they just kind of do apologetics as a hobby. And this is another problem. Mm. And we've run into it even within our own organization, because we've partnered with people who have been solo, and you know, we've had to hold them accountable, and they didn't want to be held accountable. Mm. I won't give examples or details, but we've parted ways with people a couple times now. Mm. And so what that's done for us at our organization is our board of directors, we've created policies now, basically saying that any ministry partners have to agree to these things, you know. Mm. I'll give one example, you know, in one particular case, while there were many issues in this case, one thing was the guy stopped going to church. Mm. And you're just like, well, you're an apologist. Why are you not worshiping and in community, living in community with other Christians?
Right.
So that's sort of the spiritual concern, but also like on a strategy level, if you're an apologist and you need to do fundraising to help support your ministry, you got to be in a church because you're going to be meeting people and ministering to them and with them, and they're going to become your donors. So it's just, it was like multifaceted why we're like, yeah. Okay. So when you ask what do people do, yeah, a lot of people are solo. I think a lot of people threw their books away, mm-hmm. Or they donated them. Mm-hmm. So what I did was I donated mine. Mm-hmm. I kept one book because it was a collection of essays, but yeah, it was just kind of, now granted the message within the books was good. There was nothing wrong with it. It was the messenger. So right. Yes, logical fallacy. Yeah. But for me, it was like Ravi was a hero of mine of sorts, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was a reminder that even the celebrities, the heroes are just humans.
Yeah.
And, in this case, you know, he was good at hiding his flaws.
Mm-hmm. What the gifting that somebody has makes them, when they choose to use it for simple purposes, that much harder. Like it makes them that much more effective because they're so good at, you know, like if you're a gift of interacting and leading a conversation and responding to accusations and all these things that make for a very good on the fly apologist, then of course you're going to be good at doing that in your own self-interest. And it's something that, I mean, in scripture, see, you know, like the judges, like they were really good at judging and really good at being sinful in a number of cases, because of that gifting. So it definitely, I mean, whether it's a celebrity pastor like Driscoll or a celebrity parachurch person like Ravi, just, it is crucial to have people that you are accountable to.
Absolutely.
It's a board or whether it's your local church under whose discipline you willingly submit, unless are doing something that needs to be, you know, obviously you don't just willingly submit to anyone, but there's got to be something, some levels of
checks and balances. Well, and for me, it's both. In some of these cases where, you know, we had to part ways with people and they thought, you know, I was being unfair to them or something, I said, look, this is a board decision. Here's the board members' contact information if you want to reach out to them. And if you think I've like morally wronged you, here's my pastor's contact information. You're welcome to reach out to him and, you know, and get him involved with this. Well, what's happened in the couple times that this has been the case? Nothing. Crickets.
Yeah.
No communication. Yeah. So it's fascinating, the people who want, you know, think that they should hold me accountable, they don't like accountability. That's one of the problems in apologetics ministry.
Yeah.
Is that they don't want to be held accountable.
Yeah.
I've encountered narcissists in apologetics ministry. So this gets into the celebrity, you know, kind of mm-hmm. thing. I've encountered narcissists who will take advantage of people, who will just flat out lie.
Mm-hmm.
One guy even said, get this, accountability is not in the Bible. So In some of these unpleasant conversations that sometimes you have to have, I mean, look, when you run any business, ministry or not, any business, you have to have unpleasant conversations with right. contractors or employees even.
Yeah.
That's the nature of working.
Right.
And the nature of human relationships. Well, so in these cases, I always have a board director because of accountability purposes. Mm-hmm. So that way it's not a he said sort of thing, or he said, she said. And so my board director was on that call, and this guy said, accountability is not in the Bible. And we were both dumbfounded because it's so obvious that accountability is throughout the scriptures.
Yeah. It's a major theme in the Bible.
Yeah. And so that was an apologist,
right?
Staying accountability. And you're just like, what the? Yeah. So I've really had some interesting, I've come across some interesting people in my decade plus of parachurch apologetics ministry.
Yeah.
But turning it to a good note, it is healthy and good to have multiple levels of accountability within your own organization, or for the apologist that isn't formally organized as a 501c3, still include multiple levels of accountability.
Yeah.
So multiple pastors, even have sort of an informal advisory council, mentors that you can keep you accountable. I've got one guy who keeps me accountable on my fundraising work, you know, that I have to do. I say, here's my goal. And then he checks in with me. And man, it's unpleasant when I've failed to meet my goals, sometimes even year after year. But it is helpful because in the long run, I keep on working at it.
Right.
So it's good and it's healthy. It's beneficial to have accountability partners and ministry partners.
It's essential.
Doing the solo work.
Yeah, it's absolutely essential. I mean, Lone Ranger Christianity is not a thing. It was always churches sending people, bodies of believers sending people. People that just thought, I'm sent, so I'm going to go. There's a lot of that. And that's more because of, you know, just innate human pride, desire for reputation, just a very worldly, I want status. Although there can be some pure motives mixed in. I think people are almost always a mixture of motives. And if you don't have people that you are subject to in some way, it is so easy to rationalize. To blur the lines between what is this that I want and what is the Lord leading me to.
Yep.
And it's a danger. Let me just swing it this way. We'll wrap it up here because I want to have you back on because there's so many other topics that I think it would be fun to just sit and chat about. But who are some apologists in particular? They could be scholars. They could be theologians. When I use apologist in the widest sense, I think of somebody like N.T. Wright, I'm like, he's an apologist. I mean, even if that's not his job, like presenting evidence. And who are some people that you think viewers would do well to have on their radar and to read their works or watch their material or listen to their podcast, whatever format, just some, they can be famous. They can be people that not a lot of people know about. We won't do the clickbaity thing of who to avoid because there's enough of that on YouTube as it is. I'm sure whoever's watching this, look to the side of your YouTube suggestions and they're probably going to be people warning you away from a bunch of different people. I want to do the opposite. I want to say, who are some people you think we shouldn't be reading? We as a body of believers should be listening to.
Yeah. I mean, that really depends on where the person's at in their spiritual journey. For a newbie who's maybe just heard the word apologetics, you know, I'm totally fine with referring them to Lee Strobel, right? Mm. Longtime journalist who can, his books are basically interviews with other scholars, with apologists. So Lee really is sort of an evangelist more than an apologist, but, you know, is in this sphere and it's accessible content.
Yeah.
You know,
he's a gateway. He's a gateway author.
He is sort of a gateway. Yes, that's right. Yeah. So that's for a newbie, for someone who's, you know, intermediate, to advanced, depending upon, you know, where they're at. I'm friends with Mike Lacona and Mike is the real deal. Mm-hmm. He's a scholar. He doesn't think of himself as this popularizer. He's a scholar, but he is the real deal. He genuinely seeks out the truth, even if it makes him feel uncomfortable. And he's honest with people. He doesn't sort of give these stock answers that some apologists can sometimes do. So I really admire and respect Mike. He's one of my mentors. If I do something that he thinks is out of bounds, he's going to give me a call. You know, he's going to hold, he would do that even if he wasn't asked to. I mean,
he's also, he's a black belt as well. So you got to watch it. It's a Taekwondo black belt. I'm not.
Oh yeah. Mike has all sorts of hobbies. Yeah. Like, I think he's also a saxophone player, if I recall. And he's got other things. You're just like, wow, I never knew that about you.
Yeah.
You know? and he's got other things too. He's a cool guy.
Yeah.
Let's see other people. Again, it depends, you know, where you're at.
Is there anybody, let me be specific. Is there anybody in the YouTube or podcast area sphere that you have found especially like worth, you know, whose stuff you have shared with other people or who you've been like, oh, I appreciate what they're doing. Just some other names out there to know.
Yeah. Again, it's where are people at? I mean, are they sort of layperson? Well, yeah, you've got, you know, John McCrae, What Do You Meme? Or Michael Jones at Inspiring Philosophy. Mm-hmm. They're doing good work. But they're also targeting respective audiences and types and content.
Right.
And, you know, John might do more pop level cultural commentary. Michael will go deep on philosophical stuff. So it all just depends. I got another buddy, Eric Hernandez. He's put out a new book, Lazy Approach to Evangelism, Lazy Approach to Apologetics, sort of incorporating both. He's sort of a both and guy, apologetics and evangelism. So he can do the accessible stuff, but you listen to some of his other talks and he's talking about hylomorphic dualism, right? On the nature of the soul. So it all just depends on how technical people want to get, you know. So I know that's not exactly a, hey, go check out this guy or this guy, but
it's honest. That's what I
mean. I really do try to tailor because I do get people that ask me, hey, who do you suggest reading? And I'll want to take 5 to 10 minutes to learn, hey, like, how much do you have any formal education? Right. Have you been studying this for years? You know, if it's truly a newbie, that's going to be one sort of resources, podcasts, books, authors. If someone's like, oh, yeah, I've already read through Strobel, I've read through this, I've done that. What do you recommend next?
Right.
That's going to be a different answer. So we want to, as a good apologist, we want to tailor our answer to the person.
Yeah, that's a wise approach. I think that's what I try to do here with our study Bible reviews is say this may be good for this audience and not for this audience. And then if it's something that's just bad across the board, I'll tell people, just avoid this.
Yeah, just avoid the Ken Ham stuff.
Yeah, yes, I have no problem telling people that. There are very few, like I said, very few times I'll name names, but my exceptions are when people build their platform or their ministry on being divisive against fellow believers, spirit-filled, Bible-believing, committed Christians, but you don't agree with their interpretation, so you don't consider them a Christian. That's when I'm like, okay, you are who Paul warned Titus about, the divisive person. Warn them once, warn them twice, have nothing to do with them. So it's, but I try not to do that because it's such a temptation in the YouTube sphere because it gets clicks, it gets views, it gets, you know, if you're polemic, there's a whole, maybe we could do this for another discussion, but I just see there's like this cottage industry of people analyzing theological or apologetic debates. Like you know how sports talk radio, like after the game, they'll have like 3 hours of analysis. But people do that with two apologists that debate each other.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, who's got the time or the – I mean, people do. I'm not begrudging someone if that's their thing, but I do it with Georgia football. But I don't know. The body is multifaceted, the body of Christ. And that is a case where I'm like, all right, I guess that's an appendix. It's useful for something, even if I don't know what. Anyway, we're a little bit over an hour, so I want to be mindful of your time. And it's good. One, it's good connecting with you just face-to-face through the modern miracle of technology. But two, folks, if you're watching, I want you to be familiar with Kurt's work. Veracity Hill, they're not just for the content, but as we've been talking about in this episode, the perspective from which the content is produced, and the demeanor and the approach to apologetics. I love that you're not shrill. I love that most of your videos I've seen. In fact, I don't think I've seen a video of yours where you're not smiling. Just you're friendly. And that's something that is very much missing in many popular preachers and apologists. So I just want to, Dojo viewers, he's a name you need to know. So give Veracity Hill a follow. Check it. Where can people read? What's the best way? What's your preferred way? If somebody watched this and they're like, I want to talk to that guy about something.
So if they want to watch the content, the Veracity Hill YouTube channel is the place. Mm-hmm. And then if they want to reach out to me, there's a contact form at my website, veracityhill.com.
Awesome. Yep. Well,
and James Michael, thanks for inviting me into the dojo.
You are no longer a dojo white belt. If you come back on, you will be a blue belt here in the dojo. So that's pretty exciting. I do want to have you back on. There's so much stuff I think we could talk about. And I just want to extend to you open invitation. If you're ever like, hey, I want to talk about this with dojo viewers sometime, or I want to mention this, or I'm working on this and want to get the word out. My Disciple Dojo is a conduit. That's how I look at the ministry. We're a conduit to get people to the resources and things out there that can help benefit them. So yeah, man, keep doing what you're doing. I love it. I appreciate it. And yeah, it's great. It's great to sit and chat with you.
Likewise. Thanks so much.
Again, I want to thank Kurt for stepping into the dojo. It's a lot of fun. He and I have only ever interacted via social media. So this was literally our first time actually talking in real time to each other, which is always fun. We'll have him back on. There's so many other topics that I'd love to just sit and pick his brain on and talk about. But if you enjoyed this discussion, if you haven't already, click that little subscribe button. That's a great way to let us know, hey, I like this. I want to see more of it. Enable notifications, comment, like, share this video with other people out there who might enjoy it. All that kind of stuff really helps us out. That's all for now. Stay tuned for more great discussions with interesting people here at Disciple Dojo. In the meantime, as always, keep training.